Oregon Cultural Trust matching funds. You can get more information about this on our website at kboo.fm/year-end-gift-2013.
Every Monday night at 8 o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
2013, the year of the whistleblower. U.S. spy apparatus was exposed for all to see. Join me, Linda Olsen Osterlund, on a deeper look Thursday, December 26th. My guest is Carl Massinio of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, the man responsible for the face of Edward Snowden appearing on buses throughout Washington, D.C. It's the Thank You, Edward Snowden campaign. We'll take a look back at 2013, the year of the whistleblower. That's Thursday, December 26th at 9:30 a.m. right here on KBOO.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Oregon Council 75, representing over 25,000 Oregon public and private sector employees, families, and communities, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members since 1942. More information at www.OregonAFSCME.com.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to Labor Radio. My name is John Walsh, your host for tonight. Our topic is immigration reform and the labor movement. This is a time of year when most of us gather with our families, but not everyone in the community has that possibility, and that's due in significant part to archaic laws, regulations, and government policies that separate immigrant workers from their families. Our guest tonight, here to talk with us about that, what's happening to reform those laws, policies, and procedures, are Marco Mejia, who's active with a whole bunch of organizations in Portland. I won't try to list here for fear of offending somebody. And Jamie Trinkle, who's with Enlace. And I'll let Jamie describe what Enlace does in a moment. But Marco, let's start just by talking about immigration reform and what is going on at several different levels. There's a national level, there's a state level, there's a local level, and very different pictures at those three. So maybe just kind of summarize for us what the situation is at this point.
Yeah, thank you, John, for letting me be here on the show. And immigration reform, it's a pretty big issue still. It's there. But what I can say in the national level, you know, many people know already that it is a very difficult situation. What's happening right now is that there is a number of organizations that are trying to pressure still the House of Representatives, which is not taking a vote because the Speaker of the House, Mr. Boehner, doesn't want to take to a vote. There is the belief that there is enough votes in the House to pass an immigration bill. But the group around Boehner doesn't want to do that. So what's happening in D.C. is that there's a fasting going on with a lot of people representing labor, faith communities, especially in grassroots organizations. One that you know is Eliseo Molina from SEIU, and he's the vice president or the secretary treasurer of SEIU. We have pastors and, you know, people that are presidents, national presidents of different congregations representing, you know, the Interfaith Immigration Coalition, etc. So there's a number of group of people that are still doing the fasting. Many people don't know that that's going on. And it's important that people understand that. The problem here is that, you know, it's pretty much dead. with the year, you know, ending, it's going to be much more difficult to try to pass any kind of immigration bill. Next year, 2014, is an election year. And everything is going to be, you know, based on that. And the politics are based on winning, you know, their candidates. So immigration reform, I don't think that's going to be a popular theme for many of those to win their election. And the state level, there has been a number of different events, actions, trying to pressure, especially the Republicans. And what's his name? The Republican. That it's I'm sorry about that.
Where?
Eastern Oregon.
Here. Oh yeah, Walden, right?
Walden,
Congressman Walden.
Yeah, it's one of them. But anyway, the idea is that, you know, to get all the Oregon delegation into supporting immigration reform, and they have been accomplished. But the Republican doesn't want to do that, including others that have not been, you know, very good at immigration in the past. That I'm not going to mention who, so then we don't get into those details. But now I think that pretty much everyone has been, you know, supportive of any kind of immigration bill. That's, and they have done walks, you know, and going to do rallies and sit-ins in some of these offices, and all of that has been happening. Again, the media doesn't put anything of that out. So everything that has come out is through social media and the grassroots level media like KBOO and others, right?
Maybe one thing to mention, too, as far as the state level stuff, I mean, some immigration reform increases the human rights of immigrants, and some immigration reform goes the opposite way and hurts even more the already harmed human rights of immigrants. And I'm thinking of states like Alabama, Arizona, Georgia. So aside from Oregon, other states have had different types of changes to immigration law that actually make things worse.
Yeah, no, that's important to understand, too, that also this thing goes on, I mean, in terms of this policy change around immigration and immigration reform, if you want to call it at the local level. As you're saying, there's a number of states that already have passed very anti-immigrant and racist, discriminatory and violating the human rights of people, you know, into those states into law. And it's terrible. We still in Oregon have a situation that is not as far as that one. But, you know, but at the local level, just to finish that part, you know, that you were asking, is that we have a campaign going on, and that it's run by the ACT Network, which is activists coming together for dignity and justice. And it's what they're trying to do is to really point to what is really affecting people in the day-to-day life that they have, and that is to get rid of the ICE holds in the jail. And that's what we're doing here in Multnomah County, and we're trying to make our sheriff to understand that ICE holds are not a requirement for him to do legally. It's just a request, and he has refused to change that. He changed the position that he had, that saying that totally he needs to honor ICE holds to go halfway, pretty much. But everything is not working, and now the campaign continues going until we believe that the collaboration between police and ICE, which is the immigration police, and their policies, it's a bad thing for Portland, for Oregon, for all of us, because it's actually doing the opposite, making our communities insecure. And actually, the victims of the crime are going to be, well, they are not denouncing and reporting anything to the police, because they're afraid that when you denounce to the police, and that has happened, the police come and then they realize that the victim is undocumented, and the victim gets detained and deported at the end.
So I have a list of questions here. I'm going to jump ahead and go out of order to try and dig behind some of the effects to some of the causes. And Jamie, maybe you can speak to this. The question is, who is it or what is it that profits by violating the human rights of immigrants? And what are the structures of power we need to understand to be able to design tactics or approaches to change the situation?
So many people are violating the rights of immigrants and profiting off of it. It starts really with employers who are benefiting immensely by outright exploiting their workers and conducting wage theft against folks who are afraid of entering the legal system against their employers because they're afraid that they will get caught up by ICE and get caught up by the Secure Communities, the program that Marco was just talking about, that we're trying to end in Multnomah County. It also goes to border and defense contractors. There's an immense amount of money that's being spent in beefing up our borders, especially the U.S.-Mexican border. And defense contractors are reaping in billions of dollars on that end. And then the big profiteers and folks who have really lobbied for increased immigration enforcement, including some provisions in the latest Senate bill that did ultimately fail, but maybe it'll kick back up, are the private prisons. And these two large companies, Corrections Corporation of America and GEO Group, have spent $145 million lobbying and on campaign contributions in the last decade, trying to increase immigration enforcement, basically. And they've been remarkably successful. These companies detain half of the immigrants in this country, and they've been successful in pushing forward a detention bed mandate. So at the federal level, it's actually mandated that we detain 34,000 immigrants each night. And so how are those folks being picked up? It's, you know, coming down to the local level, like Marco was saying, you know, there's this police ICE collaboration, and these people are being picked up and funneled in. And the incentive for that is actually coming from the people who profit off of keeping those people, keeping those immigrants detained behind bars each night. So these companies are making, you know, $160 a day off of detaining immigrants. And the people that are actually winding up in detention the longest are permanent residents because they have the most complicated claims. And so these people who followed like the proper process and actually have like the least risk of flight are being detained longer and being separated from their families for even longer, to great benefit to these private prison companies. And we're also seeing lobby policies that criminalize these immigrants in ways that it was not seen in the past. And so immigrants are now being turned into and prosecuted as criminals just for immigration violations. And that's all an extra incentive for enforcement and for private prison companies to continue to adulterate our political process around immigration enforcement and immigration reform.
And if we take another step back, one of the causes for immigration is the existence of trade agreements, which have effects both sides of a border. One side driving people off their farms or off their land, off their prior form of making a living, and driving them either into cities internally in many cases or across the border to look for work in other countries, specifically the U.S. and in our situation. Meanwhile, corporations make profit off those agreements. So there's a further layer to this. Maybe you want to add to that editorialized.
Oh, yeah, of course. It's terrible. what I'd like to say is that it is important, and I think that I've been noticing that more and more people are learning better about the root causes of migration, so that they go from one anti-immigrant based on stereotyping and a bad image of the immigrant to the reality, which is, you know, the human face of immigrants and why they are here. One of those is the one that you're talking about, which is the trade agreements. That it's the free trade agreements pretty much is free for the ones that have the power, you know, to define what's in there and how they want to deal with them. And usually, especially right now, things have changed so much that now who's behind these trade agreements are corporations. And more than governments, actually. So, but the governments are the ones that are helping to create the basis for the negotiations and to pass them, you know, and to push them and pressure other countries to be part of it. So the free trade agreements, you know, have really pushed people from a lot of different countries because what they are doing is just exporting, if we wanted, you know, exploitation of workers. And the basis of it is, as we know, and many of us know in our daily lives, if we work and if we have to pay for everything, that everything gets more and more expensive for us. So what's happening here is that corporations, their base is to make as much money and profit as they can. And their basis for it is to exploit as much as they can the workers and get everything, the benefit, you know, from the people that they are supposed to be, you know, serving. I don't know what I'm saying, serving is not. We serve them, actually, at the end. But anyway, so that's the dynamic, and that's what they're doing when they go to other countries. They have regulations in those free trade green agreements that makes it, actually, that the local laws and the local economies lose their own autonomy, and they're being driven by these imposed regulations, such as, you know, we understand that we know that they just come into countries like in Costa Rica, I think that was recently, and others, that they have some provisions that says that, you know, if a corporation comes into the country and they do something and they do some damage, let's say an environmental damage to the local community, the local community can denounce that. And the government can respond and say, look, you know what? We are not going to let you do that anymore, which is logic, right? Mm-hmm. And then because they want to, you know, respect the people, the community, and the natural environments there, the corporation has the right to sue them for the amount of money that they were thinking they are going to make in that place. Just for that, for something like this. So that's just an example in how things work. And of course, the other ones is that they come to create jobs, but those jobs that are really, you know, very low wage jobs in those countries that really perpetrate the poverty and the exploitation in those countries, which at the end, you know, ends up pushing those people outside of those. One of the things is amazing that like many people don't understand, you know, about the metals that we use. And cell phones, pretty much all cell phones, you know, are dirty in terms of where they come from and the labor that they've been used. And not just the labor. There have been areas in Africa that they get these metals that they have destroyed completely the area, that people cannot live there anymore, and that they have to get out of there. And some of the local wars are the ones that are maintaining people kind of enslaved working and getting those medals. That's another example that many people don't know that it's happening and that we benefit actually out of it, even though it sounds pretty crazy to say that we benefit in one way because we get a phone and we use the phone not understanding that's affecting really lives of people.
Well, in that case, it's a very raw form of violence. In other cases, it's more veiled and talking about corporations rather than governments making decisions. In the case of the private prisons, the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, which is a corporate group, put together, as I understand it, much of the model legislation that eventually was passed, toughening restrictions on immigrants at the state level. But to take a step in a different direction, okay, given that picture, given the situation that confronts immigrants, what are some of the choices tactically, strategically, for people who want to achieve immigration reform? What are the different types of approaches being tried? I mean, what are the trade-offs? Are we talking about a grassroots movement? Are we talking about something led in a central way? What are those sorts of options that are out there?
Well, I think that we need a combination of a lot of different things, right? Right now, this moment, we have an immigrant rights movement that it's a little bit divided, if we want to call it. And divided in a way that it's not that we're fighting against each other, but in a way that, you know, we have a lot of the grassroots organizing locally, like us that we're doing, you know, fighting against the ice holes, educating communities to understand what's going on and how they can, you know, become more active in terms of fighting for the rights. And then we have, you know, these groups in Washington, D.C. that work more at that level, you know, of the spectrum of the fight for immigration reform that are more focused on the politics of it. So we need both. But what we need is that they need to be connected and in dialogue. And that's what's happening just a little bit. And we need to, I think that learning from what we had so far, you know, I think that I hope that the struggle continues. I mean, this struggle has been always for years and years and hundreds of years, of course. But I think that what we need to do the next year is to kind of look back in what we've done and see what things didn't work, you know, and all of us sitting on a table at the same level, you know, and trying to understand each other's and each other's perspectives and see how we can create an agenda that responds to all the sectors, you know, of the immigrant rights movement, which it's not just immigrants, just for people to understand. The issue of immigrant rights is an issue for everyone and all our communities that are part of, you know, this country. So that's what I will say. You know, we need to continue organizing at all levels, and at the same time we need to fight, you know, in Congress and the super structures of the powers, you know, of the government, to also do the policy change that we need.
Maybe some of these choices have to do with what the immediate goal is. So perhaps, Jamie, in the case of the prison-for-profit situation, maybe that needs to be a different type of tactical approach than Marco, say, in the case of secure communities at the county level. One is more local, and maybe that's more accessible to people doing direct actions than the private prison system is. Perhaps that's part of the choice here, is how to tailor the tactics to the specific target. Thoughts on that? I mean, how do we change private prisons, for example? What's the type of tactics going to make a difference there?
Well, to back up just a little bit, one thing that I think we're starting to see is direct action coming from youth and from dreamers that is really starting to highlight the pain of family separation in a new way and kind of dramatize it. We're seeing really exciting actions where the National Immigrant Youth Alliance and Dreamers are infiltrating detention centers, private as well as public ones, and highlighting the fact that people that should not be there whatsoever are there, you know, and they're there as a result of bad policy and the need to fill this detention bed mandate. And we're starting to see folks that are actually like closing down immigrant detention ICE offices for the day by doing blockades from a sort of different, they're using tactics that have been used by other groups more in the past, like more environmental activist groups, which is really exciting to see these folks that are so so desperate for change coming together in a new way, and I think in a way that will finally push the conversation between the division, that will kind of bridge the gap in the immigrant rights movement, finally. But the tactics to take on the private prison industry, I think, do also have to come from the local. And so here in Portland, we're actually trying to push the city of Portland to divest from the private prison industry. We're trying to make the connection that, you know, there's basically two things that local governments can do to make a stand in immigration policy. And one is not participating in secure communities anymore. And two is to divest from the private prison industry, which we're all tied into through our investments in Wells Fargo, for instance, and through investments in other large companies, which are propping up this private prison industry and with their money and their social connections actually pushing for harsher immigration enforcement.
I think one thing that you said resonates with me about making the issue personal to people. And thinking back, it wasn't very long ago that marriage equality looked hopeless, that there was such a huge number of people who were opposed to it, that it seemed like it was going nowhere, right or wrong. And then it seemed that what turned the tide was that most of the population realized there's somebody they know who's affected by that issue. They hadn't realized it before, but when it became personal, when it had a human face to it and someone they knew and cared about, that changed their opinion. So perhaps that's part of the way to convert public opinion on immigration reform, is to make it be personal, have it be the mom of someone you know, or the child of someone you know, or your friend or your coworker, whatever it is. Perhaps that's the way that you get past the stereotypes and past the sort of entrenched opposition to making things different.
Yeah, I like to add also that when I was in organizing, going to the details, really, it's a lot of the things that already are happening that we need to continue doing. And one is really engaging the communities in this fight and the struggle that we have. And we have done it, you know, direct action, marches, rallies, sit-ins in offices of local officials or the county sheriff's office, et cetera, et cetera. As well as, you know, educating the community and creating the political power that could lead us to change the policy that we have. I like to, and thanks, Jamie, for highlight what the Oregon Dream Activists, which is the local group of the National Immigrant Youth Alliance, is that they have really made a pretty big, you know, historic jump, if you want it, in terms of what the fight for immigrant rights should be. We first coming out of the shadows and doing sit-ins and now doing the infiltration of these detention centers and showing how really is behind it, you know, and how the industry that is taking advantage of it, also it's profiting out of that. It's very important, I think. And that, you know, something that nobody can say no, that's, or deny that that's happening. And connecting to what you were saying, you know, that really shows the more human face of what's happening with immigrants and immigration in this country. And that's going to help to change things. historically, we know it, everyone knows, in the labor movement, the women, you know, to get a vote, to be able to vote, in the civil rights movement, the Chicano movement, the gay movement, etc. We all have seen that, you know, what we have to do now is do what they did, which is we need to mobilize, we need to educate, and really connect all of those things, you know, the political fight with the politicians and lobbying and all of that, which is not enough, but also having all the communities behind us mobilizing in the streets, you know, and coming out to say, no, we don't want that anymore.
For people who are labor activists specifically, who want to get more involved, want to see how they can plug in or contribute more to the fight for immigration reform, do you have suggestions for resources or places they might go or things they might do?
Well, I think that if they want, there's a number of things that have been happening here locally, especially. We've had immigration dialogues about immigration reform, and we've had some unions that have been participating, and of course, workers from not necessarily organizing unions, day laborers and others. I will recommend that they get connected to the ACT network. I think that we don't have a web page right now up, but actually they can connect with the organizations. You know, if they have any questions or what to do, etc., they can call Jobs with Justice here in Portland. And Jobs with Justice, if people want to take the phone number, it is.
And they can ask for Marco Mejia when they call, right?
That's right. They can ask for me or anyone else there. And the phone number is 503-236-5573. And actually, you know, at Jobs with Justice, what we have been doing also is trying to create a dialogue between workers, immigrant workers, and U.S.-born workers, to have that dialogue and understanding, you know, what the root causes of migration are and how we as workers can be working in solidarity with each other. So I think that the other organization that you can call is Enlace, right? If they have questions.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're interested in the City of Portland divestment movement, you can look at pdxdivest.com and learn more and sign the petition to City Council there. Another connection between labor and private prisons and immigration enforcement. The Oregon PERS, the Public Employment Retirement System, is actually invested directly in Corrections Corporation of America. And so folks can look that up and contact whoever's in charge of your pension fund and pressure them to take a look at that again.
And I think you'd also find private prisons are bad employers in many cases.
Oh, absolutely. They're notorious for mismanagement, fraud. There's a lot of reports on how little folks get paid, how little they get trained, and then how that in turn leads to lack of safety for the guards and lack of safety for the inmates.
And union busting also.
Absolutely.
On the part of the private prison. So there's another feedback loop there between the exploitation of immigrants and the exploitation of workers generally. We're about out of time, so I want to thank our guests, Jamie Trinkle from Enlace, Marco Mejia from Jobs with Justice, and about 50 other organizations in town. I hope that our listeners all have a chance to be together with their families over the holidays, and also that so many people who are not able to do that will before long have the same opportunity in this country and all countries. Thank you for listening to Labor Radio tonight. My name is John Walsh. Your engineer is Danielle. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline, and we'll hope to talk to you again in a week. Thank you. Good night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
You are listening to Prison Pipeline on 90.7 FM, KBOO, Portland, Oregon. I'm your host, Peter Pincel, and we will be speaking with Dan Herman, Executive Director of 211. Dan, why don't you take a second to introduce yourself for the audience?
Thanks, Peter, and thanks for having me in. I've come to 211 Info as the new CEO about 5 months ago. And prior to that, I was doing a lot of consulting work with nonprofits in the Portland area in Southwest Washington. Actually reside over in Vancouver. And prior to that, interestingly enough, I think, spent a lot of time in the private sector. So my point of view and the way I look at nonprofit work is it's incredibly valuable to the community, to society at large, but tend to take a little bit more of a business frame on things and try to bring the better sides, and I do mean the better sides of private sector business practices over to nonprofit, and just in terms of just maximizing their impact and their performance as an organization, and at the same time having just a tremendous culture, a work culture, which is something I think we do have at 211 Info.
Okay, so you say you came from private sector, but more recently you came from consulting work. What led you to 211 Info?
211 Info has an impact that's across the state of Oregon now, and it is very much information referral. Our mission, as I see it, is to make social services work better for everybody.
So maybe this is a good time to introduce 211 Info a little bit more fully.
Absolutely. So 211 Info is part of a national network, although we're independently owned and operated in that sense. But we cover the entire state of Oregon. We rolled